Dennis Hopper was the chopper-riding hippie outlaw and easy rider, the prophetic madman in the jungle in Apocalypse Now, the terrifying psychopath in Blue Velvet, and the kid gone wrong in Rebel Without a Cause. The actor was taken under the wing of James Dean, a friendship that set Dennis Hopper on his path to become a star. He was a quintessentially American dreamer, longing to be the next Orson Welles, a hell-raising director who revolutionized Hollywood. Dennis Hopper's extraordinary journey took him to superhero highs and plummeting lows. Capturing the magic and the madness of his American dream, the new book, Hopper, is a portrait of Dennis's many lives. It is Hopper, A Journey into the American Dream, written by Tom Folsom, certainly written in a rebel spirit, complemented with photographs and packed with insights from his fellow actors and artists and friends. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Tom Folsom to the program. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Thanks for having me.
It is very nice to have you aboard. What brought you to this subject? What brought you to Dennis Hopper as a subject matter?
Well, I thought his life had a terrific literary quality to it. I mean, he's sort of a rogue outlaw, and to me, in sort of a tradition of a Don Quixote. And I always saw him, you know, hitting the road on his chopper in search of his American dream. And I thought this was a thread, not just an easy rider, but throughout his life.
Your biography is fascinating because he is a very complex character. But I think it's safe to say that he was a little nuts, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a guy who, throughout the 70s, you know, he decided to play cowboy. I mean, he had on his Western wear, and he was living out in the desert in Taos, New Mexico, in a dusty town plaza. And, you know, he got arrested a number of times, one of which is when, you know, he wants some acid at a poker game, and he took it, and he wandered out, and he saw a big tree, thought it was a bear, and he shot at it with a, you know, .357 Magnum. So he was a bit crazy, for sure.
You have a great mugshot from that arrest, one of those arrests in the book as well. And so when you look at all the facets, the thing that I thought was really interesting about the book is that you have very short chapters. You go in and you tell stories, and there's just many facets to this man's life. And when you're done, you feel like you've got a very full picture of somebody who is rather erratic, who led a rather erratic life.
Well, it's almost like the different episodes of Dennis Hopper. I mean, in a way, he's almost like a twisted, you know, superhero from a comic book. And so I really tried to bring that quality, you know, to my own book. It's like another adventure in the life of Dennis Hopper. And for me, like I said before, I felt the thread was this sort of rambling journey through American pop culture. And when you look at Dennis Hopper, you're talking about the scenes he was in. This is with James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause. This is with Andy Warhol in the early 1960s, and Hopper buys one of the first soup cans, going on to Haight-Ashbury and Easy Rider and so on and so on. So I wanted to kind of, you know, bring a portrait of these snapshots of these times as well as a portrait of the man.
Do you see him as a person who, I mean, as I said in the introduction and as you describe in the book, there's these very high highs and very low lows, but overall, do you think he was happy with who he was?
I think he really dug who he was. I mean, as crazy as he was acting even in the 70s, you know, this was a guy who, you know, I think his best role was really the role of Dennis Hopper out of all of his movies. And I think that, you know, he tried to, in a strange way, he tried to live his life like this, you know, crazy Western movie. So I absolutely think that he really was into who he was. Because, you know, as any good movie, you got to have some conflict. You got to have some real highs and some plummeting lows. And Dennis just wanted to live these out.
And with that comes the fact that cannot be understated that he also was a very good actor.
Oh, he's a terrific actor. I mean, you're talking about, think about the level of training this guy had. Okay, when he's 13 years old, he begins his professional acting career at the Old Globe Theater outside of San Diego. It's sort of a replica of the original Shakespearean Theater. He keeps acting there through high school, goes to the National Shakespeare Festival there. He's like a classically trained Shakespearean actor by the time he's 18, when he's picked up by Warner Brothers. Picked up by Warner Brothers, he goes through the whole studio system. They teach the kid how to ride a horse, how to deliver his lines, how to look at the camera, this, that. And then he has this tutelage under none other than James Dean. So you look at the wealth of experience this guy had as an actor, trained at the Actor Studio as well. You know, he really knew what he was doing as an actor. I mean, he was a virtuoso.
The words that you so often hear about him, of being an outlaw, of being a chameleon, and in reading the book, they all apply in some facet of his life, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, he's an actor. He loves taking on different roles. And he also likes to be in a good movie. So he wants to find a scene that's happening right now, you know, so much so that it's not only being, you know, as he puts it, you know, he was a beatnik in the 50s, he was a hippie in the 60s. He also does, you know, the first film about, you know, the L.A. South Central gang scene in 1988, about 3 years before films like Boys in the Hood. Then in the 90s, he takes to playing golf, he's clean cut, and then he becomes, of all things, a Republican voting for George Bush.
When you look at his early, and you talked about his early acting life, but let us talk about Rebel Without a Cause and the relationship that he had with James Dean, who really took him under his wing in some ways. What lasting impact do you think that had on his career?
It totally changed his career. This is a guy who had a very specific idea of what acting was, and to him, the pinnacle of that was a guy like Orson Welles or Laurence Olivier. These were Hopper's heroes, this sort of grandiose style of acting. And then he sees James Dean just doing things that studio actors weren't doing. You know, he's almost animal in his performance. The way he somersaults out of that car before it speeds over the cliff in Rebel Without a Cause. And just like his explosive nature, that's really this raw performance. And not just that, but just arguing with the director. I mean, not just being a pawn, not just being an actor, but trying to be an artist on screen. And so all of these things just blew Hopper away. And he essentially lived the rest of his life, I think, just trying to hit that magic of James Dean.
You talk about the fights with directors, and known certainly in those early years in his early film work for his insolent behavior, and was ultimately blacklisted in Hollywood, and as you write, really owed his comeback to John Wayne.
Oh, yeah, who would have thought? Well, I think there was some sort of camaraderie between John Wayne and Dennis Hopper. I mean, Dennis Hopper would always play the sort of runny bad guys in these B-Western films. And so Wayne, you know, when Hopper was on sets, John Wayne, you know, he needed someone to pick on for all of this, you know, counterculture behavior that's sprouting around the country. And I think John Wayne's son might have gotten involved in something. I don't know, maybe it was at Berkeley, this, that, the other. And he comes on set and he goes, like, where's that commie Hopper? So, but there was a lot of, like, there was sort of a loving relationship, I think, between those two guys. And, it was Wayne who went to bat for him on the films The Sons of Katie Elder and said, you know, we got to get this kid back to work.
You talk about Easy Rider in the book, and I think when many of us think of Dennis Hopper, that's sort of the image that we have in mind. This film is now 45 years old, which seems incredible, but there it is. And it is it's an amazing piece of work. You illustrate in the book how it really was, in many ways, the first independent film, and certainly paved the way for that style of filmmaking. And what was the impetus behind it? What was he trying to accomplish?
Well, first and foremost, it was just two friends, and Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda. They were, you know, in their 20s, and they wanted to make a movie. They wanted to do it different than you know, these big studio movies that were being made. They wanted to, you know, go out and make this terrific motorcycle movie of all things. And so that was, you know, they had the chance to do it. You know, they got $300,000, and so these two kids, they went down to New Orleans and they just started shooting. You know, Dennis, of course, what people really don't, you know, realize is he's the director of this film. He knew it was going to be something great, and it's sort of Dennis's, I feel it's his, that madness that he displays when he's down in New Orleans, sort of acting crazy, and he's running around with loaded guns, and he's screaming at everybody. But there's something about that madness that makes its way on screen. And so he's really creating something, you know, a quite unconventional movie, while also making a classic Hollywood tale.
And it became his image for a while, right? I mean, not really for a while, almost for the rest of his life. I mean, when people started to think of Dennis Hopper, that became the image of what we thought of him.
Absolutely. And this is the image that the studios had of him, and it sort of worked against Dennis in the long run as well. I mean, he was seen so much as this sort of wild outlaw director who's somewhat uncontrollable, that when Dennis made his second film, his follow-up to Easy Rider, the last movie, it was very quickly shelved by the studios, who saw it as an embarrassment.
You look at the end of his life. It's 2010. He's dying of cancer, and he barricades himself inside of his house and part of his compound in Los Angeles, and then begins this divorce battle with his wife, who also lived on that compound. It became a huge story in the press. His other ex-wives, his kids, they join in the battle. They're all looking for a piece of the pie because of that that real estate and because of the art collection. And it just seemed almost a fitting way to go out for a guy because it was a tumultuous way to go. But do you think that was by design in some way?
Well, I just think it's a byproduct of
living that life,
wild life.
Yeah.
And what I thought was interesting, though, is that how does Dennis take his refuge in the midst of all this madness? He spends his last days watching old cowboy films.
And do you get a sense of, so what's the relationship then and the ending relationship that he has with his family and the price that you pay for that and living the life that he lived, as you said, a byproduct of that life?
Well, yeah, as you can say, I mean, he had more important things on his mind than being the father knows best sort of father here. I mean, this was a guy who wanted to live it all. I mean, he wanted to always be not just the guy playing the cowboy who's riding off into the sunset. He wanted to be that cowboy riding off into the sunset.
And in some ways, he got his wish.
He absolutely did. He got what he wanted. I mean, this was a guy, like I said, he loved the movie so much. He just wanted to live it. He wanted to be there. He wanted to be right there on screen, living his life in front of the camera and even off camera. He wanted to live like a crazy movie as well. So, he definitely got what he wanted, and I thought that was really sort of what made this tale important today about a kid who loved the movie so much he wanted to live him.
Do you see a not a difference exactly, but do you see a parallel in his work as a photographer and in his work as an artist and what, because it seems almost like that was a refuge at some point in his life?
Absolutely. I mean, he was a terrific photographer, and especially when he was documenting the pop art scene in L.A. that's going up in the 1960s. But he had a terrific documentary quality about his work. Again, showing what was happening in the world around him. And this is what's evident to me in Easy Rider. I mean, it really is a snapshot of that time. These guys were just taking, things that they'd seen, even on scouting trips around America, looking for locations. They'd take what they saw and they put that right in the movie. So I think that's part of Dennis's brilliance, is being able to capture the cinematic quality of the world around him.
For you, in writing a book like this, what's the big challenge of trying to characterize a life larger than life?
Well, it's just trying to make meaning and to understand what exactly is this guy trying to accomplish when he's out there living this Wild West existence in dusty Taos, New Mexico. But another challenge of writing the book is being able to walk that line between, this is a guy who really spins his own myth, and what's the reality behind that myth. So I tried to intertwine them both, and as the epigraph says in the book, and this is a quote from the Kris Kristofferson song, The Pilgrim, which is about Dennis, he's a walking contradiction, partly truth, partly fiction.
Well, the name of the book is Hopper, A Journey into the American Dream. The book is published by IT, and it is now out. Tom Folsom is the author. Tom, thank you very much for being with us. Thank you for sharing your expertise, and I appreciate you being on the program this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Hopper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.